Welcome to the Back 9 Report, presented by eDraft.com.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the Back 9 Report, presented by eDraft.com. We go live every Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time and check in on the world of golf to bring you the latest news, insights, analysis, interviews, recaps, previews. Hey, we cover anything and everything golf. My name is Carlos Torres. Every week, I'm alongside my co-host, Fred Alveda, but he's having a tough time. You know, he's playing on the links right now, maybe getting in some fancy restaurant, but he says it's all for the show. So, well, we have what better than the European guru, our friend and colleague, Kieran Clark, with us. Kieran, hi, how are you today?
Well, good evening, Carlos, and thanks for having me as always, and I'm very happy to be here. Always a pleasure to be on the show, and yes, I'm feeling good. The weather here in Scotland is absolutely fantastic right now, believe it or not. It's lovely and sunny and very warm. It's been wonderfully pleasant. Since I was last on the show, just over a month ago, and now before the Open Championship, I have moved home. I now live just outside the home of golf itself, St Andrews, so I can walk around the old course and enjoy all the sights and take in the wonderful cosmopolitan atmosphere we have in this wonderful old town. So exciting times for me, and it's very fun to do on the show as always.
Oh my God, you always saying those things, you know, Fred, to me, and I just got to do something. I got to do something to get, you know, up with you guys up there. Now you're in the home of golf. Well, someday I'll go there, visit you, and have some good time and maybe some
fun.
Well,
I would love you to come here, Carlos, and if you ever come here, I'll be here for you.
Excellent. But hey, we have an action-packed the show for you guys today, and maybe if it were for me, it would be only about the Olympics, but hey, there's something else that we have to talk about. So, but anyway, we have the Olympics, the return of golf after 112 years to the Olympics. There was action, yeah, there was some action also on the Champions Tour, the U.S. Senior Open. Also, there was tournaments in the PGA Tour. We have all that in the weekend backstream, but we have also two VIGs, very important guest of the week, John Cook, who's going to talk to us a little bit about what was going on with Nike and all that. And also, we have USGA Media Director Pete Kowalski. And in on our practice range, we're going to be previewing what else? Golf in the Olympics, but this time it's the women's turn. But hey, we have to start with the weekend backspin, and I have a lot to talk about that on the Olympics, the men's tournament. Kieran, I know you don't have the mute button, but I'll try to contain myself and try to keep these to less than half an hour, so we'll see how it goes. But anyway, you know, it took 112 years, but men's golf was finally back in the biggest sporting event in the planet, the Olympics. And while the top four players in the world all cited excuses with worries about things that have not panned out, the ones that went had a blast, had expectations, succeeded, and put on a show for the world to see. It came down to a final day showdown, mano a mano, between Great Britain's Justin Rose and Sweden's Henrik Stenson, who was considered by many as a favorite to win the gold medal, as he has been the hottest player on the planet the past couple of months. But it was Rose who came into the day with a one-stroke lead, but on the 18th tee found himself tied with Stenson, and they're displaying the battle of the previous 17 holes, but up memories of that epic battle between Stenson and Mickelson last month at Royal Tomb. After both players drove their tee shots wide right, both players hit good three wood shots, but on first glance, you know, it looked like Stenson seemed to have an advantage on the angle straight ahead, while Rose had to come from the left side with not a lot of green to work with as much as Stenson had. But Stenson opened the door for Rose to be aggressive when his chip shot was short and spun back away from the hole. Rose did went for it, leaving it a few feet from the hole, putting the pressure back on Stenson to make the long putt to force extra holes. But Stenson's putt showed the nerves he had and was uncharacteristically strong past the hole and bringing the possibility for Matt Kuchar, who had locked in the bronze after a stellar bogey 363, to possibly have a playoff for the silver. But Stenson put it for bogey, and that secured him the silver, while shortly after, Rose calmly putted for the gold, and his reaction was golden. For a man that didn't earn a single penny, he certainly displayed the emotion of one that won a major, pumping his chest towards the flag in his shirt, showing the pride that comes along with winning a gold medal for your country. Stenson also showed he really wanted it. In the end, he had to settle for the silver for Sweden, while the U.S. won the bronze with Matt Kuchar, who had said he was amazed by the nerves. He said he never felt so good to finish third, never felt this sort of pride in his chest before, and once he got the eagle on 15, he said he got his chest bumping and saying, "Hey, I got a chance." He said he didn't want it to leave putts short, but those at 16 and 18 cost him. At 16 specifically, he drove the green and three-putted, and as amazing as his round was, he could have gotten in the mix with better results in those two holes. There were many players, as many as 12 at one point, that were at 7-under, but none was able to pass that number, only Kuchar. And as for Rose, he was going against the hottest guy in golf right now, and to stand toe-to-toe with him and win it, the reaction after winning it tells it all. I mean, he went in there early, he was part of the opening ceremonies, he let it all sink in and dream about it and achieved it. Rose's wife is a gymnast, but not the kind that is recognized at the Olympics, and had said to him, "If you get there, you have to go all the way." Well, he did, and he made this a priority since the beginning of the year, and it paid off. It's a different feeling that you get when, you know, the people in Sweden and in Great Britain were hoping for those putts to go in for each one of them. A different feeling that they didn't get individually, and they were playing for a prize that hadn't been available for over a century. The pressure was palpable in the final holes, but Rose looked in complete control of his game all week. While Stenson struggled at times, you could feel he was trying to save pars at too many times in the tournament. Kieran, Justin Rose had a trifecta, a hole-in-one, hole out a par 4, and also a par 5. 20 years ago, it was a 50-yard pitch that landed him on the golf map. Now it was a 40-yard one that landed him in Olympic immortality. I'm going to leave it at here for now. We'll talk some more about the aftermath, but first, what is your reaction to the tournament?
Yeah, I think the Olympic golf as a whole went as well as anybody could have hoped. I think in many respects it probably surpassed expectations for even the most cynical of people going into it. Obviously there was, as you said there, a kind of dark cloud of players pulling out of it. There wasn't really much positivity about golf in the Olympics going into the actual week. But once the golf started, it changed entirely. I think firstly that was due to the golf course, which was absolutely fantastic. A great job by Gil Hanse, given the problems he's had developing that course in recent years. Now, there was a great concern whether the course would even be ready a year or two ago. But it was superb. It was wide off the tee. It was inventive, imaginative, rewarded creativity and skill, and it was just a really fun course to watch, and one that you want to go and play yourself, which I think is always the number one criteria for a golf course. And the players enjoyed it. And obviously had a great standard of play. And as you mentioned there, Stenson and Rose, the two of them going head-to-head, probably the two best players in the field, certainly Stenson being the Open champion, and Rose, probably anyone in the field, the one guy who was most determined to be there and to savor that whole experience. Justin has spoken about the Olympic Games now for years. There's even a tweet that people have sort of shared this week. He posted 3 years ago talking about how much he wanted to be there in 2016 and be in Rio and be part of that experience and be there at the opening ceremony and be in the Olympic Village and be with all the other athletes and all that collectivism that they have there. So he embraced it more than anyone else, so it was really fitting that he probably won it in the end. But I think it became so compelling on the last day because we got almost a match play situation between Stenson and Rose, a head-to-head battle, like you say, much like what we had at Troon with Stenson and Mickelson. And perhaps that was somewhat ironic, given that that was perhaps the format we should have had anyway, with the actual definitive match play, head-to-head format for the Olympic Games rather than a regular stroke play event. But we had that dynamic anyway with the way the two of them separated themselves from the rest. So it made for a great viewing. The standard of golf was excellent, obviously, and it was nice to see that it was so well attended. You know, unfortunately, due to various economic circumstances and other issues, the Olympic Games this year hasn't been the best attended as it ever has in Rio, unfortunately. A lot of empty seats at the various venues for different events. but the golf was sold out on Saturday and Sunday, 15,000 people there each day. And what's most encouraging about it, I think, perhaps that there were clearly some people there who hadn't been to a golf tournament before, considering a couple of folks tried to pick balls up that went off the fairway and all the rest, and there's a lot of camera clicking, and the etiquette wasn't what you would call Augusta-like, but it's nice to have these people here who perhaps have been introduced to the game for the first time. And obviously that's the greater hope with Olympic Games, and we'll talk about this in a minute or two, as the kind of wider ramifications of it as to whether it will develop the sport around the world, will grow attention for it. But as for the event itself, considering we had three really top named players at the top, it was not a strong field, of course, overall. I think you perhaps would have felt differently about it had, this is of all due respect, Marcus Fraser was one of the best guys in the European Tour, but if Marcus Fraser had won the gold medal and Seamus Power won the silver from Ireland, then I don't think you'd be quite eulogising this event like we are now. So we had the best players, they separated themselves over the 4 days, they put on a great show, and there was something about it that was distinct, it was unique, it was fun to watch. And hopefully, golf now in the Olympic Games, hopefully it will stay part of it. I think it's there, and it's earned its right to be there. When you see some of the other sports in the Olympic Games, you know, dare I say it, I think golf is a far more interesting and, again, more widespread popular sport than many other ones. You know, when you see synchronized, you know, swimming and diving and all this stuff in it, then I think golf has earned its place to be there. And I know you like horses, Carlos, but when you see dressage and all the stuff about horses dancing in gravel pits, then I think golf's earned its right to be in Olympic Games alongside those things. So hopefully it will be there going forward. But as for the event itself, it went better than anybody could have expected, I think. And that's a good thing, because whether it helps the game or not is another question entirely. We'll probably never know that for years. But golf certainly didn't do itself any harm this week, and it's credit to the players who put on a great show.
Totally agree, and you mentioned about expectations, and did it meet them? I will say no. I think it exceeded them. To me, we couldn't check all the positive boxes any better than we did. I mean, not a single player that I've heard had a bad thing to say either about experience, the event, or the golf course. They said it had exceeded their expectations. They have fallen in love with the Olympics. Most of them went to see other events, felt what it was to be part of a bigger team and love to share with their fellow Olympians. You know, the Zika, the early reports are absolutely no mosquito sightings, no rattlesnakes, no chupacabras, no walking dead or Resident Evil zombie people, you know. Although there were some caimans, you know, the little cousins of the crocodiles, which Stenson poked once with an iron, but you would see many larger animals than those in the States and in bigger quantities. So the course was a great mixed feeling between a lynx and a sandboat course. On the golf course, you can see all over and hear all over. I mean, so you know what was happening all around. It was different. The course was loved by everyone. It had easy holes, tough holes. It didn't favor any type of particular player. Maybe good iron players, and that's why you see that maybe Rose and Stenson, two of the best iron players in the game, won or were the top players. A lot of strategy was required to play in. I really have to congratulate Gil Hanse and the superintendent, Neil Cleverly, from Great Britain and his grounds crew. They did a great work with the golf course. Hanse was there also overseeing that everything was kept to high standards. Even the announcer became a mini-celebrity with his announcements off the tee. It was so enjoyable. Players eventually realized that they were playing for something bigger than them. Even the announcer said it ruined them. David Faraday said that the tension was killing him. Johnny Miller, he said he entered the week neutral, but ended up looking forward to Tokyo. Peter Jacobson, he talked about, you know, too bad the ones that didn't come, but he congratulated the ones that came and called them trailblazers and trendsetters that made history and enjoyed it. I certainly saw that interview with Ricky Fowler after he finished his last, the 72nd hole, and you could see the frustration in him that he couldn't do it. He wanted it so bad, and he was part of the ceremony. He was there in different sporting events, and that it will take him 4 more years to try and get back, and he actually was dejected by it. Rose looked like it went like, wow, I won one. He was even singing God Save the Queen as they played it. He looked really touched. Afterwards, it brought him to tears that his son, he shared a video call with his son, And his son was in tears knowing that his dad had won actually the gold in the Olympics. And he said that, you know, that made him realize how big this thing was. And he called it that it was even bigger than winning the U.S. Open. Kuchar, you could see him surveying each centimeter of the Olympic medal. Sergio said that this was tougher than the Ryder Cup, which is tough already, he said. A lot of the women were there since last week. You could see Jelena Pidler, Stacey Lewis, and others were there congratulating the medalists. You know, in all, it was a thrilling and pressure-packed, as you can expect. This is the happiest I really have seen the sport in a long while, and certainly it surpassed all the expectations. But there are a couple of other questions that I would like to ask you, and with this we'll finish our coverage of the Olympics so far. But, you know, there is the question that it did really reach international audience, that it's really growing the game. And you started to mention, well, the IOC really added as a permanent event. Is there really added revenue that it benefits the IOC from golf sponsors? I mean, do really the IOC need the golf, or is it all the other way around? What you would say?
Well, I think the IOC in the first place, well, historically when golf was announced to be in Olympic Games back in 2009, Tiger Woods was the number one player in the world back then still. And I think the IOC wanted to have Tiger Woods in the Olympic Games. He was arguably, at that time, the best known sportsman in the world, more than any other sport. So obviously things have changed since then. So I think the IOC itself, for golf, I've always been very skeptical of golf being in the Olympic Games, for the simple reason that I'm not sure the IOC is an organization that you would necessarily want to be associated with. You know, there's all various corruption scandals and all the rest of it that goes with it. So they're not the cleanest organization in the world in many aspects. However, the Olympic Games itself, you know, I remain skeptical of any potential impact golf's going to get out of this positively in terms of increased participation levels across the world and various different things. That's going to come more if golf is in long term, then perhaps we'll see more government investment and sponsors investment into developing golf in various countries. In the UK, for example, the National Lottery Fund in the UK spent roughly £300 million towards the entire Great Britain team this year. So some more of that money was to go to golf overall, and then of course in various other countries, particularly China, which also has a massive potential for any sport to grow, that would be something that could possibly happen in the coming years. But that would only happen if golf is a permanent fixture in the Olympic Games, and hopefully it will be. I think that's what we hope for. But certainly, golfing in the Olympic Games does it no harm at all. I think that's the main thing. And the IOC, you know, there's so many sports in the Olympic Games now. Most of them, you know, are not even considered by most people any other week of the year or every 4 years. And even then, some of them aren't even watched at all. But golf, it drew an audience in the United States in particular. It was the second most watched golf tournament of the year, apart from the Masters, which is always the number one by far. So more people watched in America the Olympic golf than watched the U.S. Open. So that's a big statement. So I'm not sure what the figures are internationally, and I'm not sure how easy it is to actually collate those, because various different viewing formats, because not a lot of stations, certainly in the UK, it wasn't on a network channel. It was on an interactive channel to watch behind the scenes, as it were. So it's hard to gauge an audience for that when, also in America, it was on network television and NBC and Golf Channel. So it's certainly the audiences were good. It certainly introduced the game to a different audience, people who don't normally watch golf, but that's always the case with most of the sports in the Olympic Games. You know, they're not all mainstream sports, so they're all fairly niche events, and people who do watch them, generally speaking, don't know much about those events when they're there. But the question is trying to make those people care about that sport more than just once every 4 years, and that's a longer-term question and a harder challenge. But certainly golf being in the Olympic Games, for me, overall, I was skeptical about it. I came out feeling positive about it, having watched the event, and I would like to see it become something. It might take a long time to get that way, but I think there's something about it that is quite special, is unique. The gold medal is an iconic emblem. You're watching an event where every week we watch guys play in the PGA Tour for $1 million, all the events roll into one. You're the FedEx Cup, you know, who cares about that really? Does the gold medal mean more than the FedEx Cup? Of course it does. To me, the FedEx Cup, just rich guys getting richer, and that's not compelling to us. We're watching these guys go out there, play for the country, play for the team, the whole team around them, all the other athletes in the village, and get that iconic emblem. The title means something in Olympic Games, like it does at the Masters with the Green Jacket or the Open Championship with the Claret Jug. The title itself means something, and that's a rare thing in modern sport now where it's all polluted by the money. So that's a positive aspect as well. So for me, Olympic Games, I would like to see golf grow in that in some way, become in 4 years' time in Tokyo, obviously a golf-mad nation where the crowds there will be massive, the youth figures there will be massive, and hopefully with all these other concerns that obviously we heard from players this year with Zika and all the rest of it, and various crime issues that people are concerned about, and all the other excuses they were coming up with, Tokyo much more secure and stable games in every aspect. So it should drive a stronger field next time, which can only benefit the game going forward. But I do hope that after 2020, we see golf be part of the games longer term, because I think it could benefit golf, and it will benefit the IOC by having a major sport as part of their event as well.
I hope so, too. It's going to be, like you say, this is not going to be an overnight sensation. But it was good that you say, that you saw, I mean, Nick Fowler was tweeting, and he was finding people who are all over the place. He said, you know, he was talking with people from Bangladesh, with India. There were about 2,000 at the same time saying, for Anirban Lahiri, saying, you know, I've never watched golf before, but this looks cool. I mean, there's a lot of people that tune in just to watch any sport at every time. They watch it every 4 years because the best are playing. And that's the way that you really grow the game. And when you, but it will take an effort, I think, from the governing bodies. And I'm going to take a, I'm going to say a little bit more when we're previewing the women's tournament, but I think it all will come down to the governing bodies and how they boost the game right now and try to take some of this momentum out of it. Because if they don't embrace it and they don't take it as their motivation right now to try to grow the game really globally, it's not going to go anywhere. A lot of people were surprised at the crowds there. They were saying, you know, Brazil is not a golf country. It's not. Over 200 million people and only 25,000 play it. After these games, the golf course will be a public golf course. It will be a walking course. And that means there are going to be a lot of caddies that are going to be needed. That's a great way for kids to be introduced to the sport of golf. And that's a way that you also can do it in many other countries. And you see Rahman from Bangladesh. There was a lot of people on social media talking about him. He was the flag bearer of his country. They were like, golf? What is that? Do we play golf? You know, that's a way that you really grow the game in doing that. As far as the IOC, I really know, you know, I mean, FIFA, it's worse corrupt than IOC. I really don't try to look at the organization. I look at the events and look at the players and the athletes that compete and the events and the importance of them. And the biggest competition might be a year from now when the Olympics, the IOC will vote on which events will be part of the Tokyo Games and whether golf will remain a part of the Olympic program beyond 2020. Golf's future has taken a hit, you know, with so many male players pulling out. And the IGF has said it hopes the IOC will consider the myriad of problems that were in Brazil in assessing the withdrawals. Hopefully the show that the men put on and hopefully the women will follow this week. And the IOC sees there is a future for it, just like it happened to tennis. I mean, remember, Pete Sampras was the biggest thing back when tennis returned to the Olympics, and he never went to it. He never bought into it. But look at it now. And I try to compare all the time that I've been saying golf and tennis like the same thing. All the top players were looking forward to go this time. Roger Federer was injured. He lamented he couldn't be there. Look at Andy Murray from Great Britain. He defended his goal. He wanted to be there. Serena Williams lost, but she was there, even though she could have rested an injury that she was suffering through. You know, this is an educational process and one where everyone will learn and will eventually catch on. Even Rory McIlroy said to have watched at the end of the day. You know, he congratulated Rose as well. So I don't know. Given the overwhelming success of that tournament, there is a consensus growing among those competing in Rio that the leading players who stayed away are now probably regretting their decisions. Rose, you know, he believes the scenes generated by the Olympic tournament will play their competitive instincts and ensure they will want to be part of it at the Tokyo Games in 2020. But that all said, you know, to me, the talking about the IOC and whether golf fits in and they need them or not, you know, the Olympic Games are one of the most if not the most effective international marketing platforms in the world. They reach millions of people in over 200 countries and territories throughout the world. Support from the business community has been crucial to staging those games and the operations of every organization within their movement. I mean, revenue generated by commercial partnerships accounts for more than 40% of Olympic revenues, and partners provide vital technical services and product support to the whole Olympic family. They have each level of sponsorship entitles companies to different marketing rights in various regions, category exclusivity, and the use of designated Olympic images. You know, the IOC and the organizations within them are entirely privately funded, as you will know. And they manage a scale of media rights to the Olympic Games. The top worldwide sponsorship program and the IOC official supplier and licensing programs, 47% of the revenue comes from broadcasting rights, 45% from sponsorship, 5% on ticketing, and 3% on licensing. They work on a global sponsorship base where those who make the list are the big ones, the ones who do, and the ones who give the most money and the ones who get most out of their exposure in events. The rest is divided by local sponsors from each country, and those are the mile. And let me tell you one thing. Of the 50 sponsors of the PGA Tour who has only of the 50 sponsors that the PGA Tour has, only two are in that base of 12 that the Olympic Games have as a global sponsorship. That's Coca-Cola and Bridgestone. And they would be there regardless of whether golf is included or not. As they have been long before, golf was considered an Olympic sport. The PGA, the USGA, the European Tour, and the LPGA sponsors account for zero global sponsors, and less than 2% comes from any of the sponsor of them that participate in the local sponsors. So I would like to really put to rest the myth that the IOC needs golf sponsors. That is a pure fallacy, and it's the other way around. If golf wants to be truly global and reach places that it has never reached, it needs the Olympics. It's not the way around. It's not this thing that, yeah, the IOC's benefit from the sponsors. No way. They don't need any of those sponsors. They have plenty and plenty on a waiting list. And, Kieran, before we move, I finally got here. Fred left us an audio with his thoughts on the Olympics, so let's play it.
Hi, guys. I apologize for not being able to be with you tonight, but you know me. I'm out here working for the show. Kieran, I'm anxious to hear your thoughts on the Olympic golf event. I already know Carlos loved it and can't wait for Tokyo in 4 years' time. Because we've talked about Olympic golf for so long, I wanted to give a few thoughts about the men's competition that was held last week. First, the Gilhants designed course proved once again that less is more. You don't need pot bunkers, island greens, railroad ties, or knee-deep rough to make a competitive golf course. The layout of the course did not allow for fans traipsing between holes, and because the land along the coast is somewhat flatter, grandstands were used to accommodate fans. Kieran, I know you will count this as blasphemy, but the course had the feel of watching a tournament from St. Andrews or a great Scottish links course, except the weather was better. Second, even the grizzled veterans admitted a few more nerves than normal when they teed off on Thursday. Evidently, playing for medals instead of dollars with your country's name on your shirt still means something to these guys. Third, the IOC is a money-grubbing, corrupt organization, but they know how to put on one hell of an event. From swimming to gymnastics, the competitions are always compelling. Carlos, I have to admit, golf will catch on, and I predict that the games in Tokyo will have a full complement of the best golfers in the world. Fourth, Bubba Watson is a goof, but he's maybe the most talented shot maker that has ever lived. He is amazing to watch. Fifth, I enjoyed watching the golf competition. There were enough big names in the field to keep me interested, and the combination of Peter Jacobson, Johnny Miller, Roger Maltby, and David Faraday calling the action for NBC and the Golf Channel is always entertaining. Sixth, Michael Phelps earned 23 gold, 3 silver, and 2 bronze Olympic medals in his career as the greatest Olympic athlete ever. Proving once again, you can be born with talent, but you have to put in the work and the practice to be great. Finally, I'm excited about watching Lydia Ko, Aryo Jutanugarn, and Brooke Henderson along with the South Koreans, compete this week in Rio. That should be awesome. Kieran, your buddy, Colin Montgomery, may have said it best with his succinct Scottish wisdom at the U.S. Senior Open at Scioto last week. You are a major champion for 1 year, but you're an Olympic champion for a lifetime.
There you have it. That was Fred and his thoughts on the Olympics. And Kieran, some final words on the Olympics before you tell us about what happened on the U.S. Senior Open. So some final words before you tell us about that.
Yeah, just I obviously quite enjoyed Fred's comments there. I agree with most of what he said for once. But I will say, Fred, if you're listening to this, the weather here is actually really nice right now. So the weather over in Brazil was nice, but it's actually fantastic here. They could have held the Olympic Games here in St. Andrews as we speak, and it would have been wonderful. It would have been just as good, if not better. But yes, the golf course was great. The event itself certainly surpassed expectations. Everybody, I think Fred, like myself, was a little bit skeptical about the Olympic Games and golf's inclusion in it. And I think myself and him are both positive about it going forward. We want it to become something big and major going forward in the game. There is something about it that was quite special. They put on a great show. And hopefully in future it can become something even bigger. You mentioned tennis there. You know, the tennis players love it. They embraced it. They made it something special in its own right. It's not a Grand Slam. It's not quite like that. It's something unique in itself, something that's different and distinct from every other event on the tour, and that's something unique and important. But like you touched on a minute ago, Carlos, and you'll talk about it later, but what we need to have most of all going forward is some sort of greater collusion and organization between the various governing bodies, particularly the PGA Tour, who did nothing to help the golf and Olympic Games.
Totally. But yes,
now we'll move on to a different subject, because while there was golf on at the Olympic Games, of course, there was also golf on with the over 50 players. It was U.S. Senior Open, the 37th U.S. Senior Open at Scioto Country Club in Ohio. Very near to where Fred Altbater lives, of course, and also the course where Jack Nicklaus, the 18-time major champion, the greatest of all time, he began his life in golf on this course, a course of great historic significance. Bobby Jones won the U.S. Open there back in 1926, which I think Jack Nicklaus's father went to see at the time. So it had a great historical resonance for a variety of reasons, but Jack began his career there, his life in golf, learning golf under the great teaching pro Jack Grout, who remained his coach for, you know, really for his entire career. So there's a great history there, and the older players returned to this course for the U.S. Senior Open, arguably the biggest event on the Champions Tour calendar. And it felt like a major in every aspect. The golf course was set up like a kind of conventional U.S. Open with narrow fairways and thick rough and fast greens. So it was extremely difficult, and scoring conditions were hard. There were some very good rounds, but there were also some very high ones, and as you'd expect in any USGA event. But, of course, it was blighted a little bit by the weather, which pushed it into a Monday finish, which is often not ideal. But the players still put on quite a show in the end, and it's certainly a very tight, intense final round, with Gene Sowers, who won there by a shot from Billy Mayfair and Miguel Angel Jimenez. The two of them were tied, Sowers and Jimenez, going on to the last hole, playing together alongside Ian Woosnam, and they were playing the par 5 18th and found themselves both had putts of par on the last hole, but Sowers made his after Jimenez missed his from 10 feet. Sowers made a 4-foot putt to win, which is a real emotional triumph for him, as many people will be aware of the story, but Gene Sowers, a number of years ago, was essentially on his way out. He suffered from a life-threatening disease. In 2005, he was diagnosed, or misdiagnosed, rather, with rheumatoid arthritis, and his condition worsened to the extent that he was given a 25% chance of survival at that time. He was eventually diagnosed with having Stevens-Johnson syndrome, which is a rare skin disease, and it very nearly killed him. He didn't play golf for 7 years. He returned to try and play the game after recovering back in 2012. He joined the Champions Tour a month later, and this is his first win on the tour as a senior player. So obviously a really emotional triumph for him, a great achievement for something that obviously a number of years ago would seem unimaginable. And he came so close to winning the U.S. Senior Open 2 years ago when he missed a short putt on the last hole, gifting the title in the end to Colin Montgomery, who won his first U.S. Senior Open there. So a tremendous win for Gene Sowers, a great achievement for him. You see how much it meant to him, and all our players were congratulating him. They know his story, they know what he's been through, and it was one of those feel-good stories that you get sometimes in sport, and that they're always good when they come along. But for Miguel Angel Jimenez, it's another major disappointment. He was well ahead at the Senior Open Championship at Carnoustie last month, Really should have won that event, but struggled in the last day at Carnoustie, Day, and he seemed to lose his rhythm in his game and completely out of sorts. And of course, eventually lost that event as Paul Broadhurst came through and won it. So this is two straight senior majors that Miguel Angel has not thrown away, but he has struggled in the last day. He's let himself down, and that's surprising for someone who's had such great success in recent years, since turning 40, really, winning 21 times in the European Tour, consistent Ryder Cup player, someone who still plays exceptionally well on both tours, given that he finished top 20 at the Open at Royal Troon as well. So Miguel Angel would have expected to have won this. He was certainly the favourite going into the final day, and he'll be disappointed by this once again. And Ian Woosnam, the former Masters champion who bowed out of Augusta earlier this year for the final time, he hit the ball extremely well on the final day. And Woosnam perhaps could have felt he really should have won this thing. Had he made some more putts, he left a lot of putts short. Had he made some more, he would have probably won it, because he hit the ball better than both Sowers and Jimenez in the final day. He was arguably played the best golf tee to green on the final round, but he just didn't quite hold the putts to make up for it, and came out two shots behind. So it was a very good event in its own right, obviously overshadowed by the Olympic Games. I think only 50,000 people watched the first round on Thursday, so it wasn't a real blockbuster tournament. Colin Montgomery and Bernard Lang are obviously two of the marquee names. They finished together, actually, a tie for 11th, so not quite in contention now. Disappointing week for the two of them. Well, Colin Montgomery had a very disappointing summer, having missed the cut at the Senior Open at Carnoustie as well. And Langer obviously wasn't really in the mix there either. So two of the big names who have dominated the senior majors in recent years and been at the top of the leaderboards, they haven't really shown too much in the last few weeks. So Gene Sowers came through, Carlos, a great win for him, a great story. And, you know, three other country clubs had a great history to it throughout the years, and this is another chapter in that great history.
Yeah, and like you mentioned there, the total disappointment from Miguel Angel Jimenez. It's really unthinkable to know that how good he plays, and knowing that he's not a choker. I mean, he's not that type of a player. And twice right now he has let those two big tournaments go. It's really unfathomable here. But hey, hopefully one will come soon. Hey, there was action in the PGA Tour. Finally healthy, Ryan Moore won the John Deere Classic for his fifth PGA Tour by 2 strokes over Ben Martin. For all the late pars and the closing run of 46 holes without a bogey, Ryan Moore thought the key to his victory Sunday in the John Deere Classic was the 24-foot birdie in putt in the fourth hole. It moved him to 20 under and kept him 2 strokes ahead of Morgan Huffman, who was about to birdie the fifth hole. The 33-year-old Moore finished at 22 under, 262 at TPC Deer Run, making only one bogey in 72 holes. He won the first time since successfully defending his CIMB Classic title in Malaysia in 2014. South Korea's Wee Kim shot 63 to tie for third with Hoffman at 17 under. Wesley Bryan, who was the leader Friday when play was suspended, tied for 8th at 14 under. After his second straight 70, he earned a PGA Tour card last week with 3rd at that country victory of the year. NCAA champion Aaron Wise was following his 3rd round 63 with 70 to tie for 16th at 12 under in his PGA Tour debut as a pro. The former Oregon player won a PGA Tour Canada event 2 weeks ago in Edmonton, Alberta. Zach Johnson, the 2012 winner and member of the tournament's board, shot a 69 to tie for 34th at 9 under. He's from nearby Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Madison Stricker had a 72 to tie for 52nd at 6 under. The 49-year-old Stricker, a former University of Illinois player from Wisconsin, won the event in 2009, 2010, and 2011. Finally there, Jordan Spieth chose not to defend his title because he didn't think it would be appropriate in light of his decision to skip the Rio Olympics. And finally, there was also action on the Web.com Tour. Canadian golfer Mackenzie Hughes took first place at the Price Cutter Charity Championship presented by Dr. Pepper. At Highland Springs Country Club, the 25-year-old Hughes shot a 24 under par to beat Richie Werenski, who won the 72nd hole drain and eagle putt to move him into a tie for first place at 23 under with Hughes, who then suddenly was needing a birdie to win and had not made one since the 10th hole. Well, like they say, the rest is history. He made the birdie, and he's glad he did. He's getting married in late October and the $125,000, first place check will go a long way towards that honeymoon. With the win, Hughes moves to number 14 on the PGA money list from his previous number 88 spot, securing his card for the next year on the PGA Tour. And with this, we wrap up the Weekend Batsman. We'll take our first short break, and when we come back, we'll have the Par 5 news that are coming for you. Don't go away.
Thank you for listening. We'll be right back. In the meantime, don't forget to visit www.edraft.com for analysis, breaking news, and more. Also, remember to follow us on Twitter at edraftsports and on Facebook at facebook.com/edraftsports. Now, back to the show.
And we're back, and now it's time for the Par 5 News. And Kieran, you're going to kick it off. You're going to have the tee shot here and tell us a little bit about a story from the New York Post on Tiger Woods' amateur career.
Yes, Carlos, this is an interesting story. Obviously, as we all heard a couple of weeks ago, Nike have withdrawn or announced getting out of the golf gear business. They're no longer going to produce clubs and balls and all the rest of it. They're going to just stick to their clothing and apparel. So, you know, obviously, likes of Rory McIlroy will need a new home there, a new equipment brand to play with going forward. And so that was obviously a big news for the golf industry last week. But, you know, now, why did it happen? What's the fallout developing from that? What was the business failure that led to Nike's decline? And you know, one interesting article came in the New York Daily Post, for New York Post, rather, and it also touched on Tiger Woods' amateur career, which is extremely interesting as to their perspective, whether you agree with it or not, or if there's anything to it. So the article talks about Nike's business plan in the first place. Obviously, they had Michael Jordan, you know, the great basketball player who made them an absolute fortune. He was also the biggest sportsman in the world at the time, certainly in the United States, a massive icon of somebody who almost did, the sport was him, it felt like at times, much like Tiger Woods became with golf around the turn of the century. So Nike piled money into Tiger Woods and promoted him in a certain way to obviously play up his demographic qualities. Tiger had a unique situation of being both an African-American and an Asian, being mixed race. So he had the potential, in theory, to connect with, you know, millions and millions of people in the United States and around the world who wouldn't normally have ever really, you know, considered golf to be a sport for them. And as time has gone on, that hasn't really proven to be changed too much. You know, we don't see too many African-American golfers on the tour, which is extremely unfortunate. Golf still has this barrier that prevents various races from getting involved. But as for Tiger's amateur career, an article touches on quite interestingly about how back in the day when Tiger turned pro in 1996, which is ironic given that this week actually Golf.com have released a film about Tiger winning the U.S. amateur final against, I think his name was Steve Scott, so that's an interesting little aside there. So 1996, when Tiger turned pro, Nike signed Tiger Woods, instantly turned professional, of course, for a $40 million deal over 5 years. But of course, as the article touches on this, you know, everything was instantly in place. The deal was there the day he turned pro. It was as if they'd already been done, which of course is what they were. And Tiger Woods' father, Earl, had been on the payroll of IMG, International Management Bank, so long before his son was delivered to the actual company itself. Earl was there as a talent scout, and his salary has allegedly funded Tiger's expansive amateur career. So you can also, again, look at how, while he was an amateur, IMG made his deal with Nike. Of course, I obviously negotiated on the day itself, and it happened within minutes, and it was all done there on the day. And the late Frank Hannigan, who was the former director of the USGA and someone who wrote years after in various different publications, Golf Digest particularly, and had very forthright opinions of all kinds of things, he was the one guy who said that he identified Tiger Woods' career as being a sham, that his father was essentially paid to fund Tiger's golf, then to deliver him to IMG, which then delivered him to Nike, long before he technically turned professional. And Hannigan concluded that the USGA didn't, in Tiger's case, enforce its rules on amateurism effectively. It gave Tiger a free pass because they feared accusations of racism, which of course would have been thrown against them had they done anything to stop Tiger advancing in that idea. However, you know, while this may be true to many, it unquestionably is true that these things were done long before Tiger turned professional. It was all written down before, it was all planned. But that's not something that's been unique to Tiger Woods. We look at the game ever since then, really, you know, and you know, you'd be very naive to believe that deals aren't done behind the scenes before people turn pro. You know, John Rahm turned professional recently, had a deal the next day. Jordan Spieth, of course, turned professional in 2012, very quickly had a deal with Under Armour. Rory McIlroy is another one. All these guys have deals waiting for them when they turn professional. And whether you look at the rules for amateurism on the USGA website, I looked through it this evening as to what they define as being amateurism, what they prohibit. As far as they're concerned, a parent or guardian can fund their son or daughter's career and their amateur career and travel to events and expenses and so on. So technically, that's what Errol Woods did. He funded Tiger and expenses. So in that respect, it probably was legal under the rules. I mean, it's like a grey area there, but we'll say it probably was legal under the USGA rules. That said, whether it's ethical or not is another thing entirely. However, it is, I think, a reality of modern sport. And really, it began, you know, with arguably Michael Jordan and the huge endorsement he got in the first Nike Cup tonight changed the industry. And Tiger was another one here. That whole thing developed up there, and we see it now to be commonplace where amateur players who are successful in college, or they win the US Amateur, or they're really big names, they do well in a major. You know, Bryson DeChambeau, you know, obviously contended at the Masters, turned professional, and you know, automatically had his deal with Cobra. So do we really think that that wasn't dealt with or agreed before he turned professional? Of course it was. You know, you'd be ridiculously naive and stupid to believe otherwise. So, you know, these things do happen behind the scenes. It is murky, it is arguably unethical, but you know, rightly or wrongly, it is a reality. So Tiger Woods' amateur career, you know, you could argue it was technically a sham, but so have many others, Carlos.
So could be, and it's like you mentioned, I mean, how other ways those contracts would be made right away? I mean, of course, and it happens in every sport, I would say. I mean, why would you leave your amateur career if you're not sure of what's coming up in the pros and you have a lot of those things already taken care of?
Well, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, it's just common sense, like you say. We cannot be that naive for it, but hey. Nothing can deny what was of his career anyway afterwards, arguably the best player of this generation and one of the best players ever, depending on who you talk to. Hey, another subject here. As the dramatic campaign continues to replace him, President Barack Obama appeared to be enjoying his recent golfing vacation in Martha's Vineyard. The president went golfing again last Friday afternoon, the fifth time in 6 days. His golfing partners included prominent NBA stars, Stephen Curry of the Golden State Warriors, Chris Paul of the Los Angeles Lakers, and retired players Alonzo Mourning and Ray Allen. Obama has also spent late nights at restaurants with friends and family, and he's been at the home of Robert Wolf, a former UBS executive. The only day so far that the president didn't golf, he spent on the beach with his family and taking a walk on his expensive vacation property with his daughter Malia Obama. The following meeting in mainstream media, according to them, Obama has played 300 rounds of golf since taking office in January of 2009. They actually keep track of this? I mean, wow. I mean, apparently, the president has shown himself to be the most avid golfer of any president since Dwight Eisenhower, who is said to have played 800 rounds in office and installed a putting green on the south lawn of the White House. Obama's summer vacation in Martha's Vineyard began in earnest Sunday as he hit the links for a round of golf and the president shoots, you know, in the mid-80s to the low 90s, a bit of information so secret that the source of this information spoke on condition of anonymity. The occasional partner further described the president as a competitive player and a serious scorekeeper on the golf course. Every shot counts, the source insisted, based on more than 20 rounds played with Obama. He keeps score 100% and doesn't take mulligans. Two overshots, for which former President Bill Clinton had a well-earned reputation on when playing golf. But in an interview last week with Golf Channel's David Faraday, Obama said of his golf handicap, "I am an honest 13. I think my irons are good, my drive is straight, but unimpressive in length. My putting is decent, chipping is okay. My sign game is terrible." End of quote. Apparently, this is Mr. POTUS' 38th time playing golf at Martha's Vineyard, and during his 7 visits, he has split time between 3 courses: Farm Neck in Oak Bluffs, Vineyard in Edgartown, and Mink Meadows in Vineyard Haven. But his most frequent venues for golf are the courses in Joint Base Andrews, just outside D.C., and he has played there 107 times. He has also played 54 times at for the War in Virginia and 27 times at Marine Corps Base in Hawaii. He has played only once in foreign soil. That was around on April 23 of this year with British Prime Minister David Cameron at the Grove Golf Club in Hertfordshire, UK, north of London. Obama's most frequent golf partners are current and former White House aides. The golfer-in-chief also likes to play with pals from Hawaii and Chicago, and sports figure, including retired NBA star Alonzo Mourning, who has played 14 times with the president. Obama rarely plays with other politicians, though he has played 7 times with Vice President Joe Biden. In friend-mending gesture, Mr. Obama invited then-House Speaker John Boehner to play on one occasion in June 2011, along with Governor John Kasich, both Ohio Republicans. Obama also reached out to members of Congress on May 2013, inviting 3 U.S. senators, 2 Republicans and 1 Democrat, to join him on the links. Among them was Saxie Chambliss, who hit a hole-in-one that day. Along in the foursome were Senators Bob Corker, a Republican from Tennessee, and Mark Udall, a Colorado Democrat. In July of last year, he played a 5-hour round in 94-degree heat with 3 House Democrats: Joe Courtney of Connecticut, Ed Perlmutter of Colorado, and John Jarmuth of Kentucky. An aide to Perlmutter said the next day that if the president, the congressman didn't talk politics at all, they talked sports and family. It has not escaped notice that Mr. Obama has rarely invited women to play golf, as the president has had female golf partners only on 3 occasions. I would say to that, it's not that he doesn't like women or he wouldn't like to be with them. I think he would try to avoid any President Bill Clinton type of, let's call it, scandal. But anyway, what the president seems to love most about the game, he has said, is spending times outdoors outside the White House bubble. Further, golf is a more gently activity than basketball, Obama's first love among sports. He said he worried about taking elbows and the risk of leaving his nose broken right before a State of the Address union. Yeah. But anyway, Kieran, what amazes me is not that Mr. Obama is an avid golfer. It's really how much they keep track of this golfing outing stats. I mean, this is Obama's last August summer vacation as a president, and 300 rounds he has played.
Well, that's quite amazing. And Carlos, you mentioned all the stats have been collating. I wonder if they have Barack Obama's strokes gained stats, his driving stats, his chipping stats, his putting stats. We can actually compare that to other players. I'm sure they must have that somewhere. We can see that Barack Obama's putts per round, maybe, or other things entirely. So it's amazing how much golf he has played in the last 8 years. That says probably not played that as much as I have. However, obviously, it winds people up dramatically. People get very upset about Barack Obama playing golf in America, I've noticed. Many Republicans are very angry about that. So, you know, again, for their sake, they'll be quite happy then that the next president, Mrs. Clinton, does not play golf at all. But so I don't want to upset our Republican viewers by saying that. However, I shall move swiftly on to something that we can all be united with. And that becomes to, and actually, I must quickly say, you mentioned there the anonymous source that mentioned that Obama shoots in the low 90s. You think that was Donald Trump?
I don't know. He spoke on the condition of anonymity, and I would say that if they should keep also those stats like that you mentioned, but they might say it, but then they would have to kill us if they do that. So that's why we're doing it.
Very possibly, yeah. Well, Donald Trump always shoots 59, doesn't he? So that's what he says anyway. He's always seen, he's had 14 hole of ones, and he's actually, Donald Trump reminds me a little bit of Kim Jong-il, the former North Korean leader. He kind of boasted about his golf prowess a little bit like Mr. Trump does. Not quite as dramatically, mind you, but Donald Trump's won 10, 12 club championships. Well, I think he's the only player in the field, but that's another thing altogether. However, yes, over to the Solheim Cup, which is still over a year away, when Joey Engster takes on Annika Sorenstam's European team, which should be exciting, in Des Moines, Iowa, next August. And Julie Engster, of course, a great legendary, arguably the best American player of her generation, has confirmed that Pat Hurst, Wendy Ward, and Nancy Lopez, who were all her assistant captains last year in Germany when they won the Solheim Cup, completing that dramatic comeback at St. Leon-Riot Golf Club, those three will return as her assistants next year. So they're retaining the same team altogether, the same backroom team, the same staff, to create a sense of continuity. A little bit of what they're trying to do with the men's side for the Ryder Cup, obviously with the rather silly committee they created there, bringing in Davis Love again and all these other guys, trying to create a sense of continuity and a pattern to captaining the teams. I think they need far too much into the whole thing anyway. But so those three will come back as assistant captains next year for Julie Engster, which she'd obviously be happy. She's delighted about that, of course, and they're happy as well. And again, it creates a sense of continuity, a sense of team, which they're trying to build momentum together. Because obviously Europe, before last year, had dominated the Solheim Cup in more recent years. So America's been trying to reestablish their position in that competition, and retaining the same team altogether would make the most sense in doing so. But again, I do think people read far too much into this sort of thing, and the Ryder Cup and the Solheim Cup as well, they've been taken out of all proportion. The Ryder Cup now, there are so many vice captains now, you lose track of them all. They're all there to make up the numbers. They're all there on a nice freebie enjoying themselves. It's kind of jobs for the boys, jobs for the girls, jobs for their friends. But again, it's one of those things, kind of a modern reality of sport where all these various people join in just the sake of it. However, it's good for continuity. And having Engster and Sorenstam as opposing captains, which should really build up the Solheim Cup tremendously going into next year, particularly, of course, after the controversial finish last year with the incident with Alison Lee and Susan Peterson and all the rest of it. And, of course, the dramatic finish when the Americans came back from behind to win on that final day. So the Solheim Cup's always good. We're still a year out, but it'll be here before you know it. And if it can repeat the drama of last time, Carlos, it will be quite something.
I can't wait for it, really. And of course, any time that there's news about it, we will be here to bring it to you in the Solheim Cup. And like you mentioned, the Ryder Cup, we've been talking about it here also on the show the past few weeks. It's just around the corner. And like you mentioned, the Solheim Cup is still a year away, but there are a lot of people looking forward to seeing that rematch, and there will be a lot of animosity going on it for sure. Hey, there was literally rain on Chip Lutz's parade this past weekend. As Kieran talked about, the U.S. Senior Open the weekend back has been a long weather delay forced a Monday finish in Columbus, Ohio, and this prompted Chip Lutz to withdraw from this week's U.S. Amateur. Lutz, who won the British Seniors Amateur 10 days ago, was the only amateur to make the cut at the Senior Open and will win Lowell Amateurs, which ends with an exemption into next year's Senior Open. However, he had to finish 72 holes to earn the exception. Since the Open would not end on Sunday, he could not finish the Open and make his opening round tee time at the Amateur at Oakland Hills outside Detroit. Lutz was exempt into both championships this year as the 2015 U.S. Amateur. Pat Tallent, who was the 2014 U.S. Amateur Senior Amateur winner, also withdrew from the U.S. Amateur. You know, Kieran, there should be common sense provisioning for when things like this happen. He had already earned the low amateur ranks. There was no way he was going to lose that. Hey, give him the go and let him go pursue his championship. I know, rules are in place for something, for things, but in some cases, we should look out for what's best for the players, and it's common sense that should prevail.
But Carlos, you should know by now that anything that makes sense, anything that's common sense, that's not going to happen in golf, because golf always does what's wrong. You should never do the smart thing. Sorry, Alan. Sorry, man. I kind of lost track there. It's me next year. So back to me now for I must confess, I sounded somewhat out of it there. And unfortunately, one person who is out of it a bit too often recently is Australia's Robert Allenby, who was arrested this past week in Illinois. He was arrested for disorderly conduct and trespassing outside an casino, which adds, of course, another odd situation and chapter in his recent history, which, unfortunately for him, has not been about his golf. It's been about antics and various events off the course. We all remember his situation last year in Hawaii, where he claimed to be kidnapped, which in the end, there was no record of that ever happening, and it obviously led to various questions as to what really happened there and why he got into that position in the first place. So Robert Allenby is someone who he has denied this even happened this past week, even though the police have confirmed that it did. And it's, people will make jokes about this and make fun of it all, but to me it's quite sad. The man clearly has some issues going on here. His game has completely fallen apart. He's now ranked 1,257th in the world. He has made one cut this year out of 17 events. He didn't do much better last season either. And the guy has clearly got some issues, whether it be with addiction or mental health, who knows, but the man needs some help. I think that's what's fair to see here. There's something going on in Robert Allenby's life that he needs to try and sort out. And his career has gone off the rails, and he seems to have done so as well. Two things are obviously linked together. I'm not sure what's happened in his private life to maybe cause this to happen. He's never had the best reputation as an individual. He does great charity work. He used to do it anyway, but he hasn't had the best reputation with caddies and various people that he's dealt with in the past. However, this past year and a half have been very strange. These kind of incidents are obviously alarming. When it happens once, it's bad enough. When it happens again, there's a pattern there, and it's not a healthy pattern. So Robert Allenby, I think it's fair to say, also I don't know for sure, but I think there's some issues going on there, Carlos, and he needs to get some help.
Definitely, most definitely. Hey, we're going to take now a short break, and when we come back, we're going to have our first BIG John Cook, so don't go away. We'll be right back.
Thank you for listening to the Back Nine Report presented by eDraft.com. We'll be right back. Don't forget to check out our co-hosts on Twitter by clicking their names in the episode description. Now, back to the show.
And we're back, and now it's time for our first BIG of the week. His name is John Cook, currently a Champions Tour player, who was once on the field for the U.S. Senior Open right now this past weekend on Seattle and Condor Club. And Fred talked to him on the range. John was a Nike staffer for 10 years, and he brings a little different perspective to the Nike announcement of getting out of the equipment business. He has a feeling for the people that work there and are now looking for work elsewhere. So let's play this interview for you.
Talking with John Cook here at the U.S. Senior Open at Scioto Country Club. John, it's got to be like a home game for you. Parents still live in the area. Went to Ohio State. Got to be a lot of fun coming back there.
Yeah, it's special. It really is. It's a great town. Great support from the community. Great support from the school. They love their athletes around here. They love their alumni. And you can feel it walking around here. It's great to be back. And actually, it's nice to be playing golf again. I haven't played much golf, so it's nice to be playing golf again.
Yeah, we see you on TV. We haven't seen you on the golf course very much.
Yeah, it's kind of transitioning a little bit, but I want everybody to know that when I play, I play hard, and I don't know what my expectations are going to be for this week, but I feel like I'm ready to play, and I've come here to compete, you know. I haven't just come here to visit and feel like I like the golf course. I know the golf course pretty well. Start of a nice little run for me where I'm going to actually get to play for a few weeks. Feel like my game is ready.
John, you were a Nike staff. Comments on what's going on in the equipment world these days?
Yeah, I was. They were kind to me for 10 years, and I had a really nice run with them. Won a lot of golf tournaments with the equipment. So I feel bad for that, but I feel really bad for the techs, bad for the developers, the R&D guys, the reps that you know worked with me exclusively for 10 years and beyond, and what they're going to do, where they're going to be, where they're going, their feet are going to land. It's really sad. It's sad for me to see some really, really great people, some of the best in the business, just go from something to nothing in a day. And I wish the best for all of them. It blows me away.
With a lot of changes, TaylorMade up for sale, Golfson and Smith, looking at bankrupts, you know, Adams is on the chopping block, Titleist going to an IPO. Could be a lot of changes in sponsorships this fall.
Oh, yeah. That'll be interesting to see, you know, walk up and down the line January 1st and see who's doing what with who. It'll be a whole new era, whether it's going to be more corporate or if it's going to be some companies that, they have to find out, you know, where their dollar is going to be spent. The game is fairly healthy. There's people playing, but, you know, we want the game to grow, and how to grow that. I think the companies are sitting back in their offices trying to figure, you know, how are we going to grow this game and how are we going to stay solvent. And I think that's kind of what we're looking for right now.
You see the game from a lot of perspectives. You have a golf course management company. You own golf courses. You're a player. You're in the media. So you wear a lot of different hats. So your feeling is that the game is really not as bad off as what maybe people may make it out to be.
No, I think that's right. I do see it. I mean, I see the interest in it. And, you know, I'd love to see the Olympics be a success, which I think it will. There's no reason it won't be. We've got some great players down there and well represented. But, yeah, I see it from a lot of different angles. And I love the game. I love the game so much. I love playing the game. I love being part of the game. I love talking about the game. From what I see, the excitement that's around the events that I go to and play in, people, you know, they watch television. They watch the shows. They watch golf. They play golf.
They know the game.
They know the game. They're not dumb. Again, it's about growing the game and keeping the game, you know, healthy, which I think it is. I think there's a great group of young players that are helping with the game. I think that the players that are older and moving on appreciate the game and want to keep in the game somehow, and I think that's only good.
John, thank you so much. Let you go hit some balls. I really appreciate it.
You got it. Thanks, man.
There you have it. That was John Cook. And Kieran, we talked about the Nike exit here at large, but I would like to know your take on it before we move on to our practice range.
Well, I think that I agree with John Cook there. Obviously, it's a shame for people who have worked at Nike and who will now be without jobs. And, you know, that's obviously we can talk about the industry ramifications, obviously, you know, what players are going to play with whatever clubs next year, but that's all really unimportant in the grand scheme of things. In reality, it's the human stories, and it's these people here who have seen their jobs, their livelihoods taken away from them, and that's obviously a great shame. But as for the Nike itself, obviously, I don't think anyone would ever say that those were their favorite clubs. You know, Rory McIlroy, I don't think, went to Nike because they had the best club, because they offered them the most money, and Tiger would be largely the same. So if they were going on the basis of the best club, it wouldn't be them. That said, I think the golf industry is going through a period right now where, certainly around the turn of the century, and since the first decade of this century, the industry boomed in that respect. You know, there are so many golf courses appeared, so many golf equipment companies grew. The industry got beyond what it ever was before, perhaps too big, overextended itself. I think with the whole Tiger boom and whatever else expected, the participation levels and playing numbers to rise with that, and it never quite did. And obviously in the years since 2008 recession and the great kind of the mini depression that we had around in the world, not just in America at that time, the industry has contracted since then. The number of people playing golf has declined overall. The number of people buying golf equipment has declined overall. So the industry is just naturally contracting in the marketplace. And like anything, and when the marketplace contracts, the weakest or the least popular brands are the ones that are going to fall. And Nike, even though their apparel was always very successful, their clubs weren't in particular, and that's why, unfortunately, people who work there, they will no longer exist after this year.
Totally agree, and it's been a sad story. And also, we talked about the Gulf Company, the exit and possible bankruptcy. I mean, John says that there is the Gulf is maybe at a better stage than what it's made to be, but it doesn't feel like. It might be. There's some people that say no. There's some people that do say that Gulf is in a precarious situation. And you know, I would take it like you say, no. I wouldn't say that Nike was maybe their favorite golf clubs, or people were just running away to go buy them. And maybe that's what – maybe they, Tiger Woods and Rory have carried that brand for those golf clubs. And now that Tiger is out and not being the top player that he is, I mean, a lot of marketing companies are suffering because of it. And there's a lack of a true number one dominant player to take that crown from him right now. But – I would tend to think that golf is not as bad as a thing as everybody thinks it is, but we shouldn't be relying on that, and there should be something that has to be done and change a little bit about the market of how the golf equipment industry is going around. Kieran, let's take one more short break. When we come back, we have the practice range, and we'll preview the women's golf competition in Galway.
Thank you for listening. We'll be right back. In the meantime, don't forget to visit www.edraft.com for analysis, breaking news, and more. Also, remember to follow us on Twitter at edraftsports and on Facebook at facebook.com/edraftsports. Don't forget to check out our co-hosts on Twitter by clicking their names in the episode description. Now, back to the show.
And we're back, and now it's time for the practice range, where every week we pick a topic and each of us take a swing at it. This week, well, we have to continue with the Olympic subject, and it's the women's turn, and we're going to divide this practice range into three sections. First, we're going to talk about the tournament itself. Then we're going to talk about the concept of why the women have handled the concept of the return of the Olympics different than men. And finally, we'll tell you what to expect, or players to watch, I mean, at the end of the day here this week. So let's start talking about, you know, the tournament. A Golden Globe settled over the sport of golf on Sunday when Justin Rose captured the men's Olympics Games golf crown. Now the women take center stage at the Reserva de Marapendi tomorrow, aiming to emulate their male counterparts by putting on another glittering show. While the men waited 112 years for a new Olympic champion in Rose last Sunday, the women have had an extra 4 years to find a successor to Margaret Abbott of the United States, who claimed the title in Paris in 1900. Whereas six of the top 10 in the official World Golf ranking didn't play in the men's event, a stellar field of 60 players, including three of this year's four major champions, and the top nine players in the Rolex ranking will tee it up at Rio this week. That number would have even more been more stout, but number 10, Hannah Yang, wasn't eligible because she was only ranked fifth among the South Korean women. She was number 10 and she was fifth. Wow. Further evidence of the strength of this week's 60 women field is how much more valuable this tournament is worth, whereas the men's event actually awarded fewer world ranking points than the Travelers Championship the week prior. There are a lot of more points at stake for the women. Let's put it this way. I mean, the ranking points for the men for gold were 46, for silver 27.6, for bronze 18.4. Let's compare it to the women. 60 for gold, that's 14 more. 36 for silver, 9.4 more. And 24 for bronze, that's 5.6 more than the men. And every single player in the field teeing off tomorrow to become golf's newest Olympian is hoping that some of that gold dust sprinkle over his fellow athletes by Rose can rub off them over the same Gil-Hans design course where Miriam Nagel of the host country will hit the opening tee shot at 7:30 a.m. Eastern Time. Just like Addison Da Silva in the Did It in the Man, it was only fitting that a Brazilian woman took the first tee shot in the tournament. Lydia Ko, 19 years old and the world number one from New Zealand, has already been within touching distance of a gold medal, having been photographed with Rose in the exuberant aftermath of Sunday's sellout in the Brazilian sunshine. She's the winner of the year's first major and has had her eyes fixed on the main prize in Rio de Janeiro all season. She said, and I quote, "The Olympics was probably the biggest goal of mine this year. Firstly, to represent New Zealand and obviously to compete in it. If I end up holding a gold medal at the end of Saturday and standing on the podium, I think it will be extra special, and I don't know if I would ever take that medal off." End of quote. She can anticipate a highly changed atmosphere at the Reserva de Marapendi as golf seeks to build on of a tremendous first week of competition, bringing the game to a huge global audience and the Brazilian public. World number two, Arie Tannenberg of Thailand, and number three, Brooke Henderson of Canada, who won the Women's British Open and the Women's PGA Championship respectively, are in the field after the best season of their professional careers. Tannenberg, winner of four titles this year alone, admitted when she said, and I quote, "I'm really excited to have this one moment in my life where I have a chance to play in the Olympics. It's really cool," end of quote. Korea, with four players inside the top 10, including multiple major champion in Bay Park, have a formidable presence, along with three United States representatives, Stacey Lewis, Lexi Thompson, and Jirena Piller. The USA, along with Sweden and Great Britain, already boast three medals of different colors, and the success of Rose has certainly inspired Team GB, composed by Charlie Hall and Katrina Matthew, who is the senior member of the 60-strong field at the age of 46, and said, and I quote, "I watched a little bit of Justin's last round, and that was amazing. Hopefully we can do the same as him. It's fantastic that what he achieved, and to have such a tight finish with him and Henrik was great for the game of golf," end of quote. There are also some Scandinavian sleepers looking to contend for the gold, like Norway's Susanne Pedersen and Sweden's Anna Nordqvist, and neither one of them can be discounted. Just a couple of weeks ago, even though in a very different setting and field, we got a tantalizing sample of women's international play as the U.S. won the U.N. International Crown held in Libertyville, Illinois. Kieran, we got a great action from the men and now the women with a deeper field loaded with talent and players that actually have been wanting to be here and win a gold medal. I expect fireworks all 4 days, especially on Sunday. What's your take on the tournament?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it immensely. I think really the men's event has always been the warm-up act for this. I think the ladies will be the main event, really, because, as you say, the field is so deep. You know, Justin Rose has won so many events around the world, and he's beaten far better fields than what he did last weekend, with all due respect to, you know, half a field there were guys who hadn't even played in majors before. So you really would have expected over 4 days for Rose and Stenson and Kuchar, as arguably the three best players in the field, to separate themselves from the rest, as they did in the end. But this week will be a different story, where whoever wins the gold medal at this weekend at the Olympics for the women can truly say they've beaten the best players, because most of them are all there. And that adds a whole other dimension to it. When you have all the top players there, it always feels even more authentic as a competition. So that's exciting in itself. And obviously there's been a greater enthusiasm from the female players going into it as well, and that generates a better atmosphere of positivity going into it as well. But I think it will certainly benefit from last week. Can I say, people who would have watched the golf last weekend wouldn't normally watch it, might have enjoyed it, and will probably watch this week just because it's golf again, having a chance to watch more golf. And so that's a positive thing. I'm pretty sure the men coming first, that will help the women attract more viewers than they would have done otherwise. And also it's going to be a great showcase for them. The LPGA and the LAT and all the other various tours around the world don't have the same viewing power as the PGA Tour in particular has. They don't have the same international recognition as the PGA Tour has. So to have this opportunity is a really unique one, and one that they're going to grab. And I hope it works out well for them all, because you know they're fantastic players. Most of them have a fantastic attitude. It's also a real international feel to the LPGA Tour in recent years, even quicker than the PGA Tour. You know, as you say, there's so many players in Korea now dominating the women's game, all around the world. Lydia Ko, obviously, from descending from that part of the world, but then obviously growing up in New Zealand, and there's obviously Brooke Henderson from Canada and South America as well, Europe of course. All corners of the globe are covered with players who all have a realistic chance of winning the gold medal. And that is only good for the game. It's only good for the women's game and for the game overall. It's really in terms of, I hate the term growing the game. I think it's a term that's really about making more money for the people who want to make money out of golf rather than anything more than that. However, and they're sort of trying to grow the game and increase participation levels. The one really untapped market that we have in golf is one, Asia, but secondly, women. We can get far more females playing golf than young girls, and the way to do that is to show them that actually women and young girls play golf. And they're going to see that this week. They're going to see so many young women here. Obviously, Katrina Matthews is kind of the opposite. She's an older one, but most of them are very young. Lydia Ko, of course, only 19. Brooke Henderson, 18. These are youngsters who are going to go out there, much like other athletes in various sports that are dominated by young people. I was watching the gymnastics today, and obviously all teenagers, they're doing well, of course, and people in early 20s. So, watching young people succeed and do well is inspiring to young kids. And I think the women's game could have a real potential of growing from this if, again, it comes back to the question of support and government intervention and trying to increase funding and so on at various levels, national levels. But in terms of a viewing level, I think the women's golf will be a success this week. It's going to be a really good competition because, as I say, it has the best players there. That gives it an added authenticity, gives it an added prestige to it. And it's going to be very competitive. And on that golf course, it's obviously really, again, was probably, along with Justin Rose, the biggest star of last week. And it's going to be a star this week. Of course, it was really strategic and inventive. I'm sure the players will really enjoy it playing it this week and mapping their way around. They probably watched it on television last week to understand the course as well, better than what the men did. And as you mentioned earlier, you had Lydia Ko there. Lexi Thompson was also watching the golf at the weekend. The female players have embraced the Olympic Games from the start. I think the LPGA has allowed them to do so. The LPGA has accommodated the Olympic Games in the schedule, leaving a little window of a couple of weeks, making it as easy as possible for their players to commit to Olympic Games without interfering with their schedule out with that. When the PGA Tour, on the other hand, has been the complete opposite. Of course, running an event opposite Olympic Games and John Deere Classic will also really fit, not moving anything else entirely. In the end, the PGA Championship, I'm fairly sure the PGA of America would have much rather their event was played in late August than just after the Open Championship. But the PGA Tour is an organization that's only out to increase its revenue. It's the only reason it exists, which is fine, but that's what it is. They're not interested in anybody else. And they were not willing to move the FedEx Cup or accommodate their schedule to help the Olympic Games. And until that changes, the men's side of the game will look bad within the Olympic sector. But the LPGA have accommodated it under Michael Wan. That's helped the game, the women's game. It's made the Olympic Games easier for the players to take part in. It's created a sense that the females and the LPGA and the ladies' game is serious about being part of the Olympic Games, when unfortunately the PGA Tour gave the impression that they weren't interested in it. And unfortunately that attitude seeped into the players themselves, like Rory, like Jordan Spieth, like Dustin Johnson, those guys, Jason Day as well. The PGA Tour made it harder for those guys to commit, while the LPGA have done everything they can to get the best players at the Olympic Games, and that is to their credit.
You almost said everything I was going to say about that. I really blame only the PGA Tour. The LPGA, it's not like you said, everything. The European Tour didn't put a tournament during this past weekend,
yeah,
so the men could go play there as well. I mean, it starts at the top like everything else, and I say it's only the PGA Tour's fault that the men are not there. I understand that for 112 years in the men, golf was not an objective, and every single player that was born on or before October 9th of 2009 never knew that they had an opportunity to think of representing their country at the biggest sporting event on the planet. But since then, and that was 7 years ago, when the IOC announced golf's return to the Olympics, it was time to start that massive movement to capitalize on it, to truly begin an agenda to just make it sure that they grew the game and instill in the players the importance of the Olympics. They could have made arrangements since then and allowed for the players to have a less stressful scheduling and make it easier for them to play there. Although all of the sports governing bodies back then embraced the Olympic golf and lobbied hard for its inclusion in these games, particularly because of the Olympics' potential to offer global exposure for the game, including in countries where golf is unfamiliar. Only the LPGA players and their officials have been the only consistent boosters of it. It's a mindset that goes even back two decades, where there was talk of a golf competition at Augusta National Golf Club in the 1996 Summer Olympics, a proposal that ultimately didn't pan out. Maybe it could be also because the LPGA has become a truly world tour, as well as the European Tour, and they see the opportunities to grow in places that they don't know about golf and those they can expand to. But whichever it is, it was a responsibility from them ever since they lobbied for it, because it was them that were playing and lobbying for it, which is, but it's mind-boggling. You had 7 years, you cannot make that excuse that you couldn't accommodate the schedule since then. You got to tell all the sponsors and all their, hey, this 3 weeks, there's nothing else. It's going to be the Olympics. Players are going to be able to go 1 week after, 1 week before, and their week then, it's not even going to be anything. Certainly something like the LPGA did. They gave them 3 weeks off so they can be not only part, they can have 1 week off and then go to the Olympics, be part of the opening ceremonies, and be both 2 weeks there being part of what the Olympic experience is. I really want to congratulate all 60 men and 60 women that decided to go. Most of the men that went there really wanted to be there and win a medal. Some of them went neutral. Let me see what it is and what it would be like. But all 60 have praised the experience and said that it exceeded their expectations and would love to be back, knowing the different atmosphere that it has, that it is to play in the sport's most prestigious stage. So for that part, I totally have to agree that PGA Tour has to do something in 4 years to come if they want the men to be there. But I think that the experience itself has already made the top players aware of what it is and what they can expect. And I think it'll be different in 2020 in Tokyo if finally the AOC allows it to be part of it. Now, finally, to talk about players and what to expect in this tournament. You know, in a similar situation to what we saw, I would say, in the 2014 U.S. Opens at Pinehurst, the women will be playing Gil Hanse's Olympic course the week after the men play. And as was the case 2 years ago, the women will play the par 71 from about 900 yards shorter. That would be 6245 yards from the 71-28 that the men were playing. Interestingly, if you throw out Martin Keimer's crazy 9-under, where he won by 8 shots total, those scores were pretty comparable from the different sets of tees. Only two men, other men broke par, which were Ricky Fowler and Eric Compton at 1-over that week, and only one woman, which was Michelle Wee at 2-under, ended up in the event in red figures. In other words, while Wee is in Rio, we can probably expect the leading women to shoot similar scores to those posted medal winners Justin Rose, Henrik Stenson, and Matt Kuchar. And we can definitely expect whoever does will take home the medal instead of a personal ball. Now, who would I like to watch? I think, like I said, this course doesn't favor any kind of player in particular, has easy holes, top holes, and it's very strategic. But I think that by seeing that Justin Rose and Henrik Stenson, two of the best iron players in the game, were the ones who were able to dominate it, I would say that players like Stacey Lewis, Lydia Ko, come to mind right immediately. I wouldn't say, I know that there's a lot of expectations of Arya Juntanen and Brooke Henderson, but I think Arya would be more suited to a course that she can overpower. And this, either, even though there are some holes that will require power, and she can drive the tee on. It requires a lot of strategy in what you're doing, and I don't think it will fit her game that much. Brooke, I think she can be, when she gets hot, well, she can be as good as anybody, but she's a little inconsistent on it. But I look forward to seeing what players like Lydia Ko, Stacey Lewis, maybe Invy Park. I know she must be a lot of rustiness in it, but she played a tournament last week back there in Asia so that she could take some of that rust out, but she can never take her out. If she brings her A game or feel anything like it, she would be somebody to look forward to here. And I wouldn't discount anyway, also a player, even though hasn't been playing that well, like Suzanne Pedersen, who thrives in this kind of competition. And I would be looking forward to seeing a good game from her. Also Anna Nordqvist, who can play very well. So what are your players to watch and what to expect to close this on the Olympic women's tournament?
Well, I think obviously you have to look at the usual suspects at the top. Lydia Ko obviously being the number one player to look at. Someone who obviously, as you touched on earlier, has really embraced the whole experience, is enjoying it, has a wonderful attitude. Of all the top players in either the male or female side, Lydia Ko has arguably got the best attitude of all of them. It's one that's really infectious, and she's a fantastic player and has a maturity and enthusiasm to back it up, and I think she'll do very well. But actually, I was really intrigued by you mentioning Suzanne Pedersen. I was going to mention her as well. I think when she's playing for a country, I think a different side of her comes out. Obviously, she has that playing for Europe and the Solheim Cup and a team environment. This isn't quite a team event, of course, with the format, but it feels like one being part of that, representing your country and all the other athletes in the village and all the rest of it. So I think Suzanne might come through and surpass her recent form this week and actually show some of the form that we know she's capable of. And I'm looking forward to watching Team GB. I think Charlie Hall and Katrina Matthew are two players who will be inspired by watching Justin win last weekend. And I think they'll be inspired by what's been a very successful Olympic Games for Great Britain. They've done extremely well. They've won, I think, the second on the overall medal table behind the United States. It's been a very successful Games for Britain. And I think two of them will want to try and continue that themselves. So, but I say it's going to be really competitive because the field is so strong, as I said before, and any of these players that are capable of doing well, I think they'll actually drive themselves to perform even better. While the top two or three at last week at the men's section, I think they were able to separate themselves, Rose and Stenson, I think that was more because they're just better than everybody else over the 4 days. You know, the rest of the guys, most of them, are either not in form like Ricky Fowler or Patrick Reed, or just weren't quite at that level as a player. However, this week, all the top players are there. I think they'll push each other to reach really high standards. I think the scoring will be very similar to last week, like you said. And they're all capable of doing well. It is, of course, I think, built mostly on strategy where you have to find that it's one thing having straight driving, it's also accurate driving. You have to hit the right part of the fairway to get an easier second shot in. The course, Fred mentioned the course is very similar to some of the great links courses in the UK. And he's right in the respect that they're all about angles. The old course at St Andrews, for example, is a course where it's not so much about hitting the fairway, but hitting the right part of the fairway to give yourself the easiest second shot in. A bit like Augusta National used to be before they put the rough in. And the Olympic golf course is very much like that. So it'll reward the strategists, but also the players who have the ability to consistently execute shots to go with it. And I come back to that one person again, Lydia Ko. She has the mental game, and she has the technical game to back it up. I think if she wins this, it will be great for the game. A player, again, who of Asian descent from New Zealand, someone who can touch an international audience, someone that's also extremely likable, has embraced the experience like Justin Rose did. So if someone was to win, I guess I'd like it to be Lydia Ko, because I think she would be a sitting winner, the best player to win with the best attitude and again, the best game. So I think Lydia Ko will be the person to beat, but there's so many great players, and it's going to be a really exciting, the race for third or second, that could also be really compelling. And there's a lot to play for, and I think they're going to enjoy it. I think there's going to be a really good show, and I think people are going to tune in more than would have done otherwise. I think last week inspired people who are not just not golf fans, even golf fans who were skeptical of the Olympic Games. I think they enjoyed it last week, so I expect them to watch the women's golf as well. So it should be a really good showcase for golf, for women's golf in particular, and I'm looking forward to it.
I'm looking forward to it, and like you mentioned, this should be the highlight of the tournament, of the both tournaments, because the top players are there. And yeah, I have to agree with you also with the Team GB. I mean, Charlie Hall and Katrina Matthew are two players that have said they're inspired by what Justin Rose did. Katrina also mentioned Andy Murray as part of her inspiration.
Yeah.
Hey, she caught fire in the Rico Women's Open second round there at 65 there, and she can play the styles of golf course very well. And 46, but hey, she could get it done, and her game could certainly fit very well this tournament. I wouldn't be surprised to see her do good. And she's from Scotland, right? So you would love to see that
of
happen,
course,
right?
Yes.
Yes. So with that, we'll wrap up right now the Olympic golf course, the Olympic women's tournament preview. We'll take our final break. When we come back, we'll have our final VIG and our final pods. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Thank you for listening. We'll be right back. In the meantime, don't forget to visit www.edraft.com for analysis, breaking news, and more. Also, remember to follow us on Twitter at edraftsports and on Facebook at facebook.com/edraftsports. Now, back to the show.
And we're back, and now it's time for our second part of the VIG Very Important Guest of the Week. It's USGA Media Director Pete Kowalski with a preview of the U.S. Amateur at Oakland Hills. Kowalski will head out the media tent for the U.S. Amateur this week at Oakland Hills. He gives us a perspective on the U.S. Amateur and Oakland Hills. Fred talked to him. Let's play that interview.
We're here talking with Pete Kowalski, who is on site for the USGA at all the tournaments. He does a lot of traveling every summer. And Pete, you're here at the U.S. Senior Open in Columbus this week, but you're getting ready to head up to Detroit for the U.S. Amateur next week.
I've got to get there as one of our lead people and make sure the media center is all set up and get ourselves ready for the group of media that's going to come visit from the Detroit area for the 312 players that are going to meet at Oakland Hills starting on Monday.
312 players, that is a big task.
The oldest championship in the United States for golf, older than the U.S. Open by one day. It is the prize for the best players, not only in the United States, but in the world. We started giving exemptions based on the top 50 in the world amateur golf ranking back in 2012. It's gotten a lot larger field with international players. There's plenty of countries that are represented from the field. You know, we feel that that's strengthens the field and makes the U.S. Amateur bigger than it really was before.
Well, we just saw that in the U.S. Women's Amateur, that all four women in the semifinals were international players.
Yeah, and the young lady who won the Women's Am won the Girls Junior the week before, the first time that ever happened.
Defended her junior championship.
That's correct, yeah. So she's pretty historic. Great player, 16 years old. We hope that people's eyes are turned to the Olympics, and then you look at who's playing in the U.S. Amateur at Oakland Hills coming up, and you might see some of those guys in the field in Tokyo in 2020.
Let's talk a little bit about Oakland Hills. It has a tremendous history there, of course. This is the second time U.S. Amateur's been held there. You've had six U.S. Opens there, a couple U.S. Senior Opens. What makes Oakland Hills a great golf course for a USGA event?
Well, it's just such a great test, the South Course. And the North Course, obviously, is terrific. We use both courses for the U.S. Amateur because we have such a large field. But it's a tried-and-true test of golf. It's not just because it's long. It's because the greens are fast. The fairways are canting. The rough can be thick. I was there for a preview event for media, and a lot of guys walked away from it saying, I've seen it here before, but this is a really, really hard golf course. It might be the hardest golf course I've played. And, I've heard that from professionals at the U.S. Open at Oakmont, too. So, there's the choice. The USGA goes to test players to win their national championships. The first and foremost choice is who has the best golf course, and how are the players going to be tested? And at that preview event that we had, our Rules of Competitions folks talked about how strong the golf course was and how much, not only in the physical tank, but the mental tank was going to be needed to win the championship.
Yeah, it's a seven-day deal. You've got two rounds of just mental play to qualify to get into the top 64, to even get into match play, and then you've got five more days to play.
The players always say that it's always a marathon, and you talk to the guys who advance, and they all say this is draining. And mentally, it might be as tough to handle as it is physically, And, you know, sometimes when you get down to that top 64, where you're seated really doesn't matter. The players will all admit that. The 64 guys are in the match play field. You got to be ready for anybody.
Oakland Hills has had a history of recognizing pretty good players. Hogan, Player, Palmer, Nicklaus have all won there. And I remember walking the course of the PGA a few years ago, and it is really a tough place.
You know, that's when Patrick Harrington won. Names that you said were all people that, are icons in the history of golf. Oakland Hills is a place that really likes its history. When you have a committee at the club that they call the Heritage Committee, that means there's something strong about what they feel about their history. And as a matter of fact, 2016 is their 100th year in existence. They're quite proud about that, and they're quite proud about the fact that they can celebrate the U.S. Amateur when they're celebrating their centennial.
I also want to mention that the U.S. Amateur, I try and watch it every year and kind of identify some of the younger guys who we're going to be seeing maybe on the Pro Tour coming down the road. And just to give you a few of the past winners' names over the past few years, Danny Lee, Ricky Barnes, Matt Kuchar, Eduardo Molinari, Colton Knows, Peter Uihlein, Matt Fitzpatrick, and of course last year Bryson DeChambeau. So all very familiar names.
Yeah, you know, the guys who've won the USAM have sometimes been given the wrong designation when they try to go out and play for a living. Doesn't mean that they are going to be automatic successes as professionals, but I think that we've seen more and more of the guys who are winning lately are making their names. It took Danny Lee a little while to get to the point where he won down in North Carolina, and then he's now playing in the Olympics. I think if you ask anybody who's played in the U.S. Amateur, who may be either here at the Senior Open or on the tour, if they played well in the U.S. Amateur, that's probably a pretty good identifier for how good they were as an amateur player.
Well, we heard Jack Nicklaus say that yesterday, that winning the U.S. Amateur a couple times kind of got him to thinking, well, maybe I can do a little bit better. And then he played well in the U.S. Open as an amateur, and he thought, well, maybe I can play with these guys. So it's kind of a signal for him.
Ricky Barnes has had some close calls, getting close to being a champion. He actually was in a hunt in the 2009 U.S. Open at Bethpage when we had that delayed championship because of all the rain. The guys who do well at the USAM and win it, I think there's something that they can hang on to, and if they persevere, you never know. You could be a Tiger Woods or a Phil Mickelson who have won that championship and gone on to bigger and better things.
The U.S. Amateur will be able to be seen on Fox next week, of course. You can also catch it on USGA.org with the live streaming. Pete, thank you so much for taking a minute to talk to us.
My pleasure, Fred. Hope to see you in Oakland Hills.
There you have it. That was Fred there with USGA Media Director Pete Kowalski. And just to give you a little bit of what's going on there, the action started today. And, you know, there used to be a time when a certain top-ranked golfer from Stanford, I don't remember him a lot, but he would show up at a national championship wearing his familiar red as he watched the course, and fields will just wither away. Well, the top-ranked golfer from Stanford show up today in the first round of the U.S. Amateur, but Oakland Hills and the rest of the field stood their ground and fought back. Maverick McNealy, the world's best amateur and a senior at Stanford, wore his school's colors, and his father, Scott McNealy, worked as caddy, but he stole out of the gate and fought his father most of the day and shot a 3-over 73 on the south course there at Bloomfield. And Darren Armstrong, a junior at Lipscomb University, a 4,000-student private school in Nashville, Tennessee, was 5-under in his last 12 holes and on the north course and shot 6-under 64 to take a one-shot lead late in the day, and that's the leader right now. So, Kieran, do you have any words on it before we go to our final parts?
Well, only say it's a great shame that it's somewhat to be expected, I guess, but the Olympic Games, I think, quite overshadowed the U.S. Amateur. I think people almost forgot it was on this week. I must confess, I forgot all about it until yesterday when I saw it mentioned, which is a shame because it's a great event with a fantastic history. And like you said in an interview, it's an event that has at times been a great outlier to identify potential champions of the future, maybe champions in the professional game. So an event obviously with a great history and when I'm right down the championship in the UK, it still has a great allure to it, and I will certainly pay attention over the weekend.
Oh, certainly, and I have to agree. This is something else that as well should have been taken out of this time and put because the Olympics are just taking a lot of it, and it's such a shame that unless it's mentioned by somebody, you wouldn't know that it was on. And like you mentioned, you wouldn't even know. I knew because Fred had told me that he had this interview, and that's how I remembered. But I have been so hooked up on the Olympics that I really forgot about it. There was anything else other than that on the TV or anything else.
Yeah.
But hey, we have some final thoughts, and you're going to talk to us about Dave Faraday and some other people. So what do you have for us in your final thoughts?
Yes, of course, David Faraday, who is a former European Tour professional, former Ryder Cup player, of course, in the last 20 years, has become arguably the most popular golf broadcaster in the United States. People always enjoyed his insights and comments and witty analysis about various different things, and he's made a fantastic career for himself. But he also does a lot of great work on the humanitarian side with U.S. soldiers and military personnel, and he's done this for a number of years now, and finally he's going to get some recognition for it, rightly so. And he has raised tens of millions of dollars for GIs who have been injured in both Iraq and Afghanistan in recent years, and of course in conflicts there dating back over the last decade. And George Herbert Walker Bush, the former president, of course the 41st president, will be awarding David Faraday with the Bush Cups Foundation's Humanitarian Award at a special dinner later this year in October. And Faraday was the co-founder of the Faraday Troops First Foundation, which has provided assistance and support to soldiers wounded while serving in Middle East war zones since its formation in 2008. And he said, and I quote, "I grew up in an urban warfare environment in Northern Ireland, so I'm used to sectarianism, murders, troops on the streets, bombs going off, an enemy that wouldn't wear a uniform and hid behind women and children. I visited Iraq in 2007 to see what Americans were doing over there, and it was a great job in incredibly trying circumstances. I came home determined to do something for them, and that's how the foundation came about." And obviously they've done some great work supporting men and women who have come back with physical injuries, even mental injuries, of course. It's obviously post-traumatic stress disorder is a massive issue with military personnel, and his foundation's done a great work to support that, so he's being recognized for that later this year, which is certainly well-deserved. And also a few other things as well, and perhaps most intriguing was an article on Vijay Singh, the former world number one, the three-time major champion from Steve Eubanks in the Global Golf Post. And Vijay is being an enigmatic and very mysterious character in so many ways, one of the greatest players of his era, one of the most hardest working players of his era, someone who the public have never really had a real insight into, mostly because he didn't give anything away. It's really been the topic of this article, where it's talking about how last week at U.S. Senior Open, which of course Vijay led after round one, so Vijay went into the media centre there and did his press conference and really spoke for 15 minutes without saying anything. That's what he's become an expert at doing over the years, where he gives nothing away. We know that it's very hard to connect with Vijay Singh because he doesn't allow you to do so, and he's always been very harsh with the media and very difficult with the media, not getting anything away at all, not being a great person for stories or quotes out of which is a shame because it has, again, it's led to fans and people who watch the game feeling disconnected from someone who they really should appreciate as being one of the best players of his era. But Vijay, even though he has a very cold and difficult relationship with the media, many players have commented on him as being someone they like or they've got on relatively well with in the past. Brad Faxon, who was working, of course, for Fox Sports there at Ciota, he was asked about it. He spoke about spending time with Vijay and enjoying his company. But then, of course, on the other hand, Vijay's had various other incidents that have suggested that's not the case. Of course, that famous fight with Phil Mickelson, and there's been issues with Tiger Woods down the years as well. Vijay also has a very cloudy and murky history within the game. He was banned from the Asian Tour back in 1985, banned for life indeed, due to changing the score on his scorecard. So Vijay back then was labelled a cheat, and that was proven to be the case, and he very quietly went about trying to rebuild a career, which he did in Africa indeed, winning the Nigerian Open. and that kind of set his career on the path it went, and he won the Masters and the PGA Championship twice. So he had a really fascinating life, coming from real rags to riches story in Fiji. There was racial tension in Fiji as well back in those days he had to overcome, as well as poverty and all these different other things. So he has a really fascinating story, Vijay, but he's never really let us into it, which is a shame. And of course, he wasn't present at the Olympic Games, even if he would be there for Fiji, who of course won their first ever gold medal in the Olympic Games with the Rugby Sevens. They won there, beating Great Britain in the final. Obviously, a massive moment for that country. People were staying up to all hours of the night to watch it, millions of them, and hundreds of thousands of them, I think, people live there. And Vijay did not participate in the Olympic Games, and no one knows why. He mentioned the Zika virus, but that's unlikely to affect him. I'm not sure he's going to have any more children at the age of 53. No one knows why. And again, that's Vijay. And he was asked about it, and all he said was no. And he wasn't willing to tell anybody why he didn't go to the Olympic Games. So Vijay's an enigma, someone who, a complicated figure, someone who has never really been able to understand. They're always conflicting. There are good sides to him, clearly, and there have been some dark sides to him. But we've never been able to get a full picture, which is a shame, Carlos, because he's someone who I think has certainly been one of the best players over the last 20 years, but we've never really been able to understand him.
I have to agree. I still don't understand that thing about the Zika virus for him. Well, who knows? Maybe he's thinking about having some other children. I don't know.
Well, who knows? You never know. Perhaps he'll be surprised, and there'll be some little mini VJs running about next year. You never know.
Right. I mean, he was a late bloomer in golf, so maybe he's a late bloomer for that as well. So who knows? But anyway, let me tell you about when Stacey Lewis tees it up at the Olympics in Rio de Janeiro tomorrow. She will do so as a married woman. Lewis and Gerard Chatwell were married in a small ceremony among family and friends in Mystic, Connecticut, last Saturday, not this one, the past one. Chatwell is the women's golf coach at the University of Houston. The couple is expected to arrive in Rio last Saturday. It was expected. They were there, and they were there as well on Sunday with the Olympic women's golf competition beginning tomorrow. Chatwell, as you might remember, proposed to Lewis last November while the couple was visiting Lewis' alma mater, the University of Arkansas, for a football game. Also, once pitched by Mickey Mantle and Joe Frazier, Natural Light Beer has returned to the world of sports. On Thursday, the brand, more commonly known as Natty Light, announced it had signed PGA Tour golfer Smiley Kaufman to endorse its product, and the former Vestavia Hills High School standout took it to Twitter and Instagram to share the news that he was joining forces with the company famous for supplying college kids on a budget. Kaufman, who's 24 and currently ranked 70 in the world, seems like the perfect face for a beer company with college students as the main demographic. That given his young age, his young looks, and the popularity among young fans. I really can't wait to see the video they're going to make, because it's almost certainly going to be incredible with him. And one last thing worth mentioning on the John Deere Classic that we talked about before was that Eric Compton, best known for having undergone two heart transplants, was disqualified for missing the Pro-Am. What makes this crazy is that he wasn't even meant to be in the Pro-Am tournament until two other players withdrew. Jim Furyk suffered a similar fate at the 2010 Barclays, but he had little excuse that week, given that he simply overslept. For Compton, he was some 6 hours away in Detroit when he was notified that he had moved up the alternate list and therefore was unable to make it to the course in time to take part of the Pro-Am. As a result, he was removed from the tournament, one he, quite frankly, needed to compete in. He currently sits in the 164th place in the FedEx Cup standings, with just this week's Wyndham Championship remaining on this regular season. So he will now need to post a very high finish if he is to make the top 125 heading to the lucrative FedEx Cup playoffs. The PGA Tour typically makes players exempt from Wednesday's pro-ams if they are attending sponsor events or media obligations. Compton's predicament, however, did not fall under any excuse absence. Unfortunately, Kieran, common sense once again and compassion does not always prevail. With that,
but Carl, as I said, that's golf for you. That's what happens.
That's what it is.
If you ever come up with a good idea to save the game, It's not going to happen. That's the way it is.
It unfortunately is that way. Well, if we have some final thoughts, any final thoughts you want to say?
Run by stupid people.
Any final thoughts regarding anything before we close the show?
Oh, sorry, Carlos, that button there. But yeah, I always say I've enjoyed being on the show again. I always enjoy spending time talking golf with you. Obviously, Olympic Games was the first half of it was very good, surpassed all expectations. I'm sure the second half now, the women, the expectations are higher for this now. So we can only hope that they match or even surpass it. And if they do that, then we've had a great return to the games. And, you know, golf, I hope it has a future going forward in the games. We'll find it, obviously, in the next couple of years whether that's the case. But I think, despite the unease going into it and the concern about whether all those players withdrawing would actually affect the golf's future in the games, I think golf this past weekend has made a case for itself, and I think the women will make that case even stronger. And I actually do think that golf's future will be in the Olympic Games going forward. And given what we've seen already and what we'll see this week, I think, Carlos, that can only be a good thing.
If I watch all four rounds all the time for the men, for the women, I'll watch that and the post shows and everything that comes with it. So that's for sure. Well, Back Niners, that wraps up another week of the Back Nine Report presented by eDraft.com. Thank you for listening. It's always our pleasure to bring you the latest on the world of golf. Special thanks, first of all, to you, Kieran. You always do a masterful job. I wish I could do it that way with your great knowledge and unique style. Thanks for being in on the show. Thank you very much. Also to our VIGs. VIGs, very important guests of the week, John Cook and the USGA Media Director, Paul Kowalski. Don't forget to join us again next Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time here on Blog Talk Radio. Or if you missed it, check it out on iTunes or tune in. And if you haven't done so, follow the show on Twitter. Our ID is at Back9Report. My name is Carlos Torres, along with Kieran Clark. We wish you to be happy, be blessed, and enjoy the great game of golf. Happy golfing, everybody.
Good night, everybody.